It is so easy to buy things these days. Just one click and you're done. That blue blouse with the scalloped collar will be delivered to you. So will that sofa throw that looked like it would go perfectly with your couches. But when these things arrive at your house, you find that the blouse is just a little too tight in the chest, and the colors of the caftan totally clash with all the other colors in the room. But man, repackaging it is a hassle, and getting to the post office, for our younger listeners, this is a physical location where you send things to other people. That can be a real hassle, and so it sits there, thrown in a box in the back of a closet. And then the next time you find that you've bought something that you really don't want or have room for, that closet gets a little fuller. We seem to have become a society of accumulators. Our next guest sees no end in sight. Alana Semuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and she wrote a piece entitled, "We Are All Accumulating Mountains of Things." Alana, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I totally relate to your article. I understand that there are things, I just moved actually, and there are things I brought with me that I don't even think I need. Why are Americans amassing so much stuff?
Well, it's gotten so much easier to shop, right? So before the internet, you had to go to a physical store, you had to drive there, you had to park, you had to look for something. They might not have what you needed. Now there's this store online that basically has anything you could ever want, and you can shop anytime. You know, I interviewed one guy for the story who says he wakes up in the middle of the night and sometimes buys things kind of half asleep. You can talk to your Alexa or Google assistant to buy things. So it's really easy to do. And then, of course, the rise of global manufacturing has made things much cheaper than they used to be. So you can get a pair of jeans for $5 directly from China.
That is true. But then it costs you like $20 to send them, right?
It depends. China actually has some pretty cheap shipping rates. It sometimes can cost as little as $6 to ship from there.
So I'm intrigued by the guy who buys things in his sleep. This seems like more of a disorder than just accumulation.
It's funny. I was looking on Twitter, and there are actually a lot of people that said this. You know, I asked him, and he said, well, I always buy stuff that I end up using, so it's not a big deal. And he's able to stop himself from buying things. You know, he was going to buy this pizza pool float that he saw, and he's like, you know what? I don't have a pool. I'm not going to buy a pool float. So I think for a lot of people, it's just something fun. You know, you get a dopamine hit when you buy stuff, and it's just kind of a hobby, I guess.
So what are Americans spending on?
A lot of stuff. Clothes, shoes. We bought 66 garments a person last year, spending 20% more money than 2000.
Wow.
Some of the stuff is related to phones and devices. You know, you have a device and then they change it and you have to get a new charger, you have to get new headphones, and devices, you change them every couple years.
Mm-hmm.
Personal care products, you know, lotions and hair products, stuff like that. You know, I think at a lot of colleges, people's parents send them, you know, crackers or kind of non-perishable foods. So just kind of all sorts of stuff that we just use in our daily lives.
66 garments per person. I don't think I have that many garments in my closet, much less replace them every single year. Who's buying this stuff?
That's a good question. I mean, I think some of it's probably stuff like socks and underwear.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is obviously averaged out per person, but this is from the American Apparel and Footwear Association. And, yeah, as I said, it's just so cheap.
Are there more of us? Are there more people and we're just buying more things?
There are more people, but the amount of stuff we buy, you know, for instance, telephone and related communication equipment, right? From 2000, we spent 4,000% more than we did in 2002, and the population only rose like 13%. So there are more of us, but each of us are also buying more stuff. And part of that is because some of the stuff we're buying is probably lower quality. So maybe you buy a shirt, you wear it a couple times, it gets a hole, then you throw it out.
So what is the big deal here? So we're buying more stuff. It's in our closets. We eventually throw it away or give it to Goodwill or recycle it in some way. So what's the big deal that we are accumulating so much?
I mean, part of the problem is that a lot of it can't be recycled. So textiles, they're working on figuring out how to recycle textiles, but are not quite there yet. So you might send something to Goodwill, and they'll keep it if it's in good quality, but otherwise it's going to go into the landfill. So a lot of textiles go into the landfill, about 66% of textiles go into the landfill. Mm. Plastics, you know, you throw the plastic bottle in the recycling, you feel good about yourself, 75% of plastics go in the landfill.
We throw them in recycling?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So you think about, I always think about the movie, the Pixar movie WALL-E, where humans have abandoned the planet because we bought so much stuff and then discarded it that there wasn't any room left. And, you know, we're not quite there yet, but you just kind of have to wonder as the population grows and as countries like China and India have a bigger middle class and they start to shop more, what are we going to do with all this junk?
So one of the things, this struck me when I first read it is kind of a first world problem. But what you're saying here is this really isn't a first world problem. This could be a serious problem for the planet if it's not already.
Yeah. And I think, you know, National Geographic had a really interesting series about plastics this summer. And it was really kind of plastics everywhere across the world. People are just discarding all sorts of plastics. They're ending up in the ocean. They're ending up just in places that they shouldn't be. And then, you know, China, we had been sending a lot of our trash to China. And last year it kind of said, you know, we don't want any more trash. We're getting enough. You can't send us anymore. So, you know, there is signs that we're running out of places to put it.
So one of the things that you wrote in your article is that houses are bigger and we're using more storage units. Wouldn't you think, I guess maybe I didn't because I brought stuff with me, but wouldn't you think that people would realize that they're being overrun with stuff?
I think people kind of convince themselves that they need this stuff, though. You know, I find myself doing this. It's kind of like, I'm an environmentalist. I'm not going to buy too much stuff, but boy, do I need another sweatshirt because it's cold out. And so, you know, I think as we accumulate more stuff, we convince ourselves we need more stuff. You think about 100 years ago, how much more stuff we have than we had then. Right. I talked with one professor who asked his students to kind of count the number of belongings they had on them in sitting in class. It was something like 50. You know, if you count the number of things you carry around with you, I'm sure, you know, if you took a time machine back 50 years, people would be like, what is that? All that junk.
Yeah, because most of it's electronic, too. So is this inspiring people to just get rid of their stuff? Is this making the zero waste movement even bigger?
Well, there definitely is a zero waste movement. And, you know, Ann Patchett, the author, wrote this really interesting essay last year where she said, I'm not going to shop for a year. And there are a bunch of people that kind of followed her lead. But I think, you know, at the same time that there's a growing zero waste movement and anti-shopping movement, we're also in this booming economy. And people are feeling really good. You know, maybe household income is kind of flat from the 2000s, but it's higher than 2011. So kind of every year people have more money and they're spending more of it. So I think at the same time there's this zero waste movement, there's also this kind of growing consumerism and they're canceling each other out.
So one of the things that struck me as a first world problem is that there are people who don't have the choice to shop during the year. I mean, there are people who simply don't shop for a year because they can't afford it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think only about 30% of households who have incomes under $25,000 are Amazon Prime members. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, you know, in response to this story, I got a lot of emails and tweets from people that said, I live in this rural location. I don't have that much money, but, you know, it saves me money, gas money and time to just shop online. And, you know, when I shop online, I do it I'm very considerate about it. But, you know, I'm being conservative when I shop.
So what are the dilemmas we're looking at moving forward from this?
I mean, I think one of the big things is what we're going to do with all this stuff, how we're going to get rid of it, how we're going to recycle it.
Right.
The other thing is, you know, these bigger houses are really interesting. It's just fascinating to me that houses have gone up every year. Despite the recession, house sizes are growing. And then I think quality of items. So if we keep wanting to buy cheaper and cheaper stuff, are we just going to end up with a bunch of stuff that breaks after a year or two? And that's going to make the trash problem even worse. You know, I think it's all about the trash.
Alana Semuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and she wrote a piece entitled, We Are All Accumulating Mountains of Things. Thank you for this conversation, Alana. I'm going to go reassess my home.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Morning Show. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Parents and children all over Wisconsin are perhaps a bit nervously preparing this morning for the first day of school. When they walk into the school building, they will likely be met by a smiling and enthusiastic school administrator. And they will walk into a classroom with a teacher who is ready to jump in and get to know who they are. But we know a lot of education professionals are also paying attention to policy discussions and the gubernatorial and legislative races. What do they want to see? Educators and administrators, we want to hear from you. What policy changes or successes will affect the schools you work at this year? Give us a call. You're probably getting dressed and getting ready right now. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We are talking this morning with Sarah Burmeister. She is a clinical assistant professor of educational policy and leadership at Marquette University. She also used to be a school superintendent in Oak Creek, correct, Sarah?
That's correct.
And you were superintendent for like 14 years, right?
Yes. And actually, it's Oak Creek Franklin.
Oak Creek Franklin. I remembered half of it.
I know. We don't want to forget the Franklin portion.
Right, because the school districts merged, right?
Well, there's a portion of Franklin that is in the Oak Creek Franklin School District.
Okay.
And then there's a portion of Franklin that's its own.
Got it.
We just don't like to have the Franklin people feel left out.
I totally understand. I totally get it. So many Wisconsin students are starting class. Teachers, staff, and administrators are getting into gear. They're getting ready, as I said, probably right now, listening to us, making sure they have everything. They're also thinking, though, about funding, about safety. As a former superintendent and teacher, what is this time like for our school teachers and leaders? She dropped. You're here. Okay. Sorry.
No. At this particular point in time, I think one of the things that's such a struggle for leaders, whether it's teachers or administrators, is that there are so many competing priorities that they have to deal with right now. And I heard your point about them being very excited and so anxious to see the students and really looking forward to a great year, but they also know all the pressures and stresses that come with those competing priorities.
And what are those pressures and stressors?
A lot of it has to do with the accountability issues.
Mm.
A lot of it has to do with kind of the, there are so many changes happening so quickly with things related to, for instance, the teacher evaluation process. I think some lack of clarity around the Every Student Succeeds Act and what that's going to eventually look like and what that's going to mean. That's what replaced the No Child Left Behind. So I think, you know, they're excited as all get out, but there's also a number of questions about what will transpire.
So the Every Student Succeeds Act, I a few years ago, maybe about 9 or 10 years ago now, I was covering Common Core when that was being put in place.
Right.
And there was a lot of confusion there. There were teachers who understood it in a certain way and were moving forward and teaching it. There were teachers who understood it in a different way. Parents were totally lost. Is Common Core still part of the curriculum here?
I think it is for the most part. Part of it is there was such a lack of communication around that. Most people were finding out about Common Core from people like you in the media, newspapers. I mean, there was not as great a clarity around it as I think needed to happen, obviously. But I think to a great extent, while some states have tweaked or modified the Common Core standards, most states, including Wisconsin, they're pretty much still in place. And I know at Marquette, in the teacher preparation program, we're still preparing our new teachers for those Common Core standards.
So when teacher, in your best scenario, you're teaching teachers, they're going into the classrooms, what is the best scenario for a teacher and for students to succeed?
Well, first of all, a real strong relationship between the teacher and the student, each individual student. I think every student just needs to know that that teacher cares about that individual, not just as a student, but as a person. So I think really building those relationships, finding out those students' needs and interests and abilities, and really working to help them become more successful. And I think part of the problem that we've had with the accountability issues is that we become so focused on those test scores, sometimes we lose those other pieces that would help certain students become more successful.
We are talking to Sarah Burmeister. Sarah is a Marquette University professor and former school superintendent. We're talking about education policy in Wisconsin as students are going to their first day of school around the state. Educators and administrators, we want to hear from you. What policy changes or successes will affect the schools you work at this year? How does policy and how does do these standards that you have to think about all the time affect you and your teaching? Would you like to be able just to get to know your kids and teach without somebody always looking over your shoulder? What about communication policies, such as how schools use social media to the community and with students and families? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's go to those communication issues. Technology has made it a lot easier to communicate with students' families. I appreciate that. I appreciate getting a text. Yet it can also be fraught with challenges. A number of schools have policies and guidelines in place. What do schools have to weigh when it comes to social media communication?
I think one of the best uses of it is to communicate with parents. I mean, that certainly is very, very effective. Where we have difficulties with the social media policies is what happens outside of school that affects the school. So whether it's students using social media in inappropriate ways to harass each other, perhaps, and then those issues carry into the school, or whether it's just people sharing misinformation or miscommunicating, and if people rely solely on social media, it's hard sometimes to get the more accurate information out there. And so it's always a struggle because you don't want to rely on any one source of media to communicate that information. So I think while social media is great in terms of communicating very quickly and efficiently, there are other times when we need to provide much more detailed information. And how do we provide that in a way that we can ensure that parents get that information, are able to read that information, are able to ask questions about that information and get clarity? But I think so often we've as a society, we've been reduced to, that quick news information, and we aren't as deliberate in finding more information and really searching it out. I think we can provide, oh my goodness, even before social media, you could provide 5 different ways to communicate with community members or parents, students, but it didn't always mean that we hit on the way that was most effective for each person.
One of the things that I've thought about, I talk to my kids about social media. I don't necessarily keep up. I don't like Instagram, so I don't go on it all the time. I know they're on it, though. But it seems to me like schools would do well to hire a social media person to just monitor, Instagram and monitor Twitter and monitor Snapchat to see kind of what's going on and see what things are bubbling up. Would that be a good idea? And do schools do that?
I would be interested in knowing what, you know, in terms of legally, whether you could do that, to what extent you could do that. I couldn't answer that question legally. I do know, for instance, in Florida, they did pass a law. It was a very, basically an omnibus law that related to several things in response to the Parkland shooting. And part of that is that any information on social media needed to be tracked and communicated with police and schools and mental health institutes and anyone else that would have any connection with those particular concerns.
And you're concerned about whether this is legal or not, whether this will stand
right.
up.
I mean, I know they passed the law in Florida. I also know that there have been some concerns about how that can be implemented, and I'm curious to see how this will play out and whether or not that will be illegal, and if so, if that's something that all school districts then would be able to do.
We will talk about this in a moment. Sarah Burmeister is a Marquette University professor and former school superintendent. As we're talking about education this morning, we're going to be back and taking your calls. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking to Sarah Burmeister this morning. She spent 14 years as the superintendent of Oak Creek Franklin School District and is now an assistant professor of educational policy and leadership at Marquette University. We're talking about what educators want and need from public policy, and we are asking for your opinions. Are you an educator? Can you take a few minutes from getting ready for the first day of school to tell us what the issues are for you regarding education policy? We'd also like to talk about communicating with parents. Does your school use social media? And what are your social media policies? What education policies in Wisconsin and in the nation would you change? We also want to remind listeners that we're taking your back to school stories, which will air in about 10 minutes during the last quarter of the hour. What is your favorite memory from your first day? Were you one of those kids that relished the first day of school with your backpack and your new shoes? Did you love getting into the classroom, or was it kind of stressful? Tell us your story. 800-642-1234. ideas@wpr.org is where you can email us, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So before we start, Sarah, we did get an email from a teacher in Milwaukee. Her name is Amy, and she says, as a teacher, I want politicians to put reasonable caps on class sizes, 25 max for middle and high school and academic classes, less in elementary school. What are the caps now, Sarah?
It's entirely up to every individual school district.
Oh, wow.
There are some districts that have a policy that caps it, and there are districts that have simply a recommended number of students, but not a cap, not a hard cap. And there are some that don't have anything. So it varies entirely by school district.
So I would think that some schools may not have enough kids to necessarily have to deal with a cap, but some schools, especially in urban areas, do have those issues. What are the biggest school class sizes you're seeing these days?
You know what? I'm hearing class sizes as large as 40 in some of Milwaukee public schools. I mean, the students that we have in our graduate program who are teachers in MPS are reporting numbers of that size. I don't think that's typical in most districts, but it seems as though that is more typical for MPS.
For MPS, which is Milwaukee Public Schools,
Milwaukee,
right?
Yes.
How do you teach 40 kids?
Honestly, I wouldn't want to. I've been in classrooms where I observed some student teachers from Marquette who are in classrooms where it's very difficult for them to get around the room. Mm. So if you're trying to have students work in small groups, for instance, I mean, the teacher literally can't get from one area of the room to several other areas of the room just to be able to check and see how students are doing. So it's certainly a challenge. And one of the things we know as a teacher, proximity is very effective in terms of monitoring student learning and student understanding. And if you can't get near the students to find out if they're understanding it, if they're learning it, it makes it more difficult.
And you talked at the beginning here about a differentiation and making sure that you have a relationship with every student. That's hard to do when you have 40 students in your class, even 30 students in your class.
Well, and think about it this way, too. If you are in a high school or a middle school and you're teaching multiple sections, it's not just the 40 students you have that period. Mm. It's the 40 students you have the next period and the 40 students you have in the period after that. And you're talking about trying to learn about 150 students at times. It depends on if you have block scheduling or traditional scheduling, how many students you have at one time.
Right. So
definitely a challenge.
We talked with Bridget Bowden about beyond the ballot question in terms of school choice just a few minutes ago. You were superintendent of a school for a long time, and I'm sure you saw this choice issue come and go. And one of the people that commented said that I believe in public schools. I want to send my kids to public schools, but money has been taken out of my public school because of choice, and I've got to follow the money because my kid needs a good education. What do you say to parents who are doing that?
I don't know that. Well, first of all, I totally believe that every parent has a choice. So I wouldn't want to take any student or any parent's choices away for their children. I think to say you have to follow the money might be incorrect in the sense that the money that charter and voucher schools receive is actually less than typically what the revenue limit per pupil is in the public schools.
Hmm.
So it is certainly money is going away from it, but it's not, there's actually less money going towards voucher and choice schools than there is towards most public schools anyway.
But is it hurting public schools? I mean, if you are paying for a teacher and money goes away, you still have to pay for that teacher, right? You still have fixed expenses.
Right. The concern is whether you still have student enrollment such that you need to be able to provide for those teachers for those classes. I think where we see it hurting the most is when schools still want to offer like the AP courses, which provide students with college credit.
Mm-hmm.
If they pass an AP exam, after taking the AP course, they get college credit for it. Well, if you have such few students, you still have to run those AP courses, but you might be running it with 8 students for one teacher instead of, 25 students for one teacher. So it can hurt in those ways. It can hurt in more the specialized areas.
We are talking to Marquette University's Sarah Burmeister. She is a clinical assistant professor of educational policy and leadership at Marquette, and she was a superintendent for 14 years. Coming up, we're also going to ask people about their favorite back-to-school stories. We're going to open the phones on that for the last segment of the show, which is in a few minutes. I want to get back to this Every Student Succeeds Act, Sarah. You talked about it earlier. States have to implement their plans, and Wisconsin's needs to be approved by January of this year. So what are educators looking at? Do we know yet the basic outlines of what this plan is going to look like for Wisconsin?
Yes, the basic outlines have been put in place, and I think all information has been sent to the Department of Education. At least that's my understanding. I could very well be wrong. What I have been reading regarding all of the state's plans that have been submitted so far to the U.S. Department of Education is that there really isn't significant difference from what was in place with No Child Left Behind.
Ah.
There are a few states who have really made some significant changes, and I should have looked this up really quick. I believe Connecticut is one where they are changing their state assessments and they're really focused more on personalized learning and project-based learning and having students demonstrate their learning in that way rather than just taking what we used to call a paper and pencil test. It's now done on computers, but it's still similar to the traditional paper and pencil test.
Are student evaluations of teachers part of this?
They are. I think one of the things that happened with the waivers for the No Child Left Behind under, when states had to have 100% of their students proficient or advanced by 2014, we knew that was unrealistic, so states had to apply for waivers, and one of the requirements for the waivers was that some type of student assessment of student learning had to be part of the teacher evaluation process. And I believe the states have all kept that component.
And I've read a lot about this, that some teachers think that they're incredibly unfair, but there are people like you, educational professors, who look at it as data and think that there are really fair ways to get at what students think of their teachers. Where do you come down?
I think that, for instance, when we teach the instructional leadership course at Marquette, which is supervision and evaluation of teachers, we talk about the fact that as supervisors, administrators need to be looking at evidence of student learning. And that shouldn't just be limited to a state test score. It should be looking at when they're in observing the teacher, talking with the students, making sure that the students can explain what they're learning. It's looking at student work that shows student growth. It's looking at multitudes of information, not simply test scores. Mm-hmm. And I think there's definitely a place for test scores, but there's a place for much more information than just that, especially since some teachers don't have any state test scores associated with them.
Right.
Now, if you're not teaching reading, if you're not teaching math, you don't have those state test scores. If you're not teaching, for instance, if you're teaching the primary grades, kindergarten, first, they don't have test scores yet.
Music. We don't have test scores for music, and yet I think that's very important. I want to just read a caller who asks about cell phones, the use of cell phones. Is there a policy on that? He can't imagine trying to teach young people in a world of cell phones. Do school districts have a policy of put your cell phones in these cell phone pockets as you walk in the door?
There are all kinds of different policies in place. And I can tell you that from what I've learned with supervising students at Marquette and working with the graduate students there, I have yet to hear a school that has been able to do it successfully.
We are talking to Sarah Burmeister. She's a clinical assistant professor of educational policy and leadership at Marquette University. Thanks for being with us, Sarah.
You bet. Thank you.
And we are taking your favorite memories from the first day of school, 800-642-1234. Tell us your story in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. My mother and I had two different ideas about what my first day of first grade would look like. My mom had been telling me that since I was a big girl now, I would be going for a full day. And I was excited by that. I was a big girl. I was growing up. So my six-year-old self assumed that meant I would be kissing my mom goodbye in the car and heading through the school to my classroom by myself. Proudly, like a big girl does. My mom had different ideas. She wanted to walk me to class, but she's a good mom, so she let me choose. I chose wrong. The school area beyond the kindergarten section was confusing, and I suddenly felt totally alone. And what was I thinking, asking my mother not to come with me? I cried, and a teacher or some kind parent led me to my classroom. And my mom walked me to school the next day. What is your back-to-school story? We are taking your calls right now, 800-642-1234. We are also taking your emails at ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR.mornings. And we're going to start with this question. Did you or do you take the obligatory photos? Is it always in front of the same backdrop? We're taking photos of my kids Wednesday when they start school because they're sophomores. What is your favorite memory of your first day? Did you really love getting to the classroom? Or was it stressful for you? Was it hard for your family to gather the supplies you needed? What do you remember about that day? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. Or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're sitting here with Sarah Hopeful, who is one of the producers for the morning show. And actually, you're kind of a jack of all trades here. Sarah, you are a triplet.
I am a triplet, yes. So going back to school was always a big to-do. We'd get the list, you know, from your teacher that with all the supplies you'd need. And I would absolutely love organizing, you know, the materials for my brothers. We'd, you know, make a big Target trip. We'd come home and then one by one, I would like make a very well-crafted pile with the notebooks and the folders all lined up and the erasers. And I loved organizing all of our school supplies. And
did they mind that?
No, they were like, oh, what is she doing? You know, it's me. I'm obviously a girl. And then, you know, it was my two boy brothers and they did not care at all. And I just loved organizing these school supplies. And it was what I looked forward to every year. So going back to school, while some kids hate it, I was like, yes, I get to organize the school supplies.
Did you all have the same teacher or were you deliberately put in different classes?
I was in the Greendale School District. And we usually there one of us had to share a teacher because there just wasn't enough teachers to go around. But I do remember in eighth grade, shout out to Mrs. Patterson, she would always, before tests, say, you know, no cheating, no looking at other people's test, no triplet telepathy. Like, she always called it out. She's like, because all three of us were in the same eighth grade algebra.
Interesting. Yeah, see, that's hard when you get to middle school. I have twins, and I always separated them until they got to middle school. And then they were just put in the same classes because, you know, algebra's kind of worked into their schedule. We've got a call from Cassie from St. Francis. Welcome to the program, Cassie.
Hi.
Hi.
So my story was when I was a kindergartner, and it was my first day of school. And after school, I got on the bus to go back home, and it was full. So I was like walking towards the back looking for somewhere I could sit, and there was a seat like open with a boy in it, and everybody told me don't go there, but I did, and then he ended up choking me.
Oh no.
And then when I got off of the bus, my dad saw my throat, and the next day he went up and he had to make a big scene, and then I think that guy got kicked off the bus after that. But that was my first day.
Interesting. And did that color your view of boys from then on or for a few years? Or was it just, you know, this kid was kind of weird?
Yeah, that kid was definitely the weird kid.
Interesting. Well, thank you. I hope your educational experience got better after that.
Oh, it totally did.
Okay, cool. Thank you, Cassie. Cynthia from Menominee, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was fortunate enough to get at least 1 year in at the one-room school that my grandfather and my mother and aunts and uncles went to.
That's awesome.
But I remember meeting with my sisters on the road the rest of the kids from our nearby village and walking to the one-room school. I don't remember ever having been in that school before, but I felt so comfortable because these were my playmates. And it was a small school. There were five children, including me, in my first grade, three in my sister's third grade.
Wow.
We didn't have kindergarten.
And where did you go? You said you got one year in. Where did you go after that one-room school experience?
This would be in 1957, and then the district was consolidating schools. So the other interesting thing is in second grade, the tornado of 1958 had gone through, and they were building a new school, but the tornado took out a portion of it, so we didn't start school until the end of September, and we had to go to school on Saturdays to make up for the days we missed.
Oh.
So that my first day of school was almost a month later than the rest of the school district.
Interesting. And you still have these memories. We all still have these memories of the first day of school or something that caught us. I appreciate you sharing that with us, Cynthia. I also want to reach out to people maybe who were homeschooled and then went back to school. Maybe you went back in middle school or you went back in high school. Was there a stark memory that you had, the difference between being home and kind of being comfortable and then going in with all these kids? Or were you just glad to be with a bunch of kids because all you had to talk to when you were homeschooled mostly was your parents? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We talk to people who work here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Connie is one of those people. And she's talking about back in 1960, they didn't take photos because film was expensive. So she says she does remember that no matter what the temperature, they always wore their new fall clothes on the first day. And I remember that being in Vegas, that was a problem because first day of school in Las Vegas is hot. It's still summer then. But I would always want to wear my new fall clothes also. But for girls, it was usually a sweater and a wool skirt with knee socks. Connie says it's funny that because she doesn't remember being too warm in classrooms, which were, of course, not air conditioned. She says she does remember the great relief of walking home in the afternoon with a sweater off and your knee socks down around your ankles. What is your story? 800-642-1234. Sarah, did you and your brothers take the bus?
We lived close enough that we could walk to school, so yeah. we often walked. We didn't take the bus too much.
I will remember, as a parent, my kids took the bus when they were in kindergarten, and they got off on the wrong stop.
Oh, no.
And it was their first time coming home, and the bus driver should have had a schedule, and I didn't really know what the other stops were, so there was sort of this panic as I was on the phone walking around the entire neighborhood with the people from school on the line. But I finally found them. I mean, they're still around.
Good.
So I finally found them. But they don't take the bus. They prefer to walk or ride their bikes. Debbie from Milwaukee says she was so nervous on her first day of kindergarten because she'd always been at home with her mom and all of her siblings. The nerves overwhelmed her, and her kindergarten teacher tried to console her. It was then, and this is a problem the teachers have all the time, it was then that Debbie threw up all over her teacher. It was a memorable day for sure, and I'm sure the teacher also remembers this. These are the hazards of being a teacher. Patrick posted on Facebook, "My first day of school was kindergarten 1972. We played with trucks, and then we sang songs, and then we did numbers. And I didn't want to go home. I remember, Sarah, when they taught me words, there was this sort of like explosion in my head. And I was like, whoa, this is what these letters are for. This is the coolest thing in the world.
Learning to read is very exciting. I do remember that feeling as well.
Learning to read is like the most exciting thing in the world. 800-642-1234. If you want to get in something at the last minute here about your first day of school. We appreciate the people who did post on social media and who did call us and share their stories. Happy first day of school, everybody. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman.